Blog Talk Radio.
CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. I'd like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We return you now to William L. Shirer in New York.
Here is a flash just received in our newsroom. Dateline, Washington. United States Army transport carrying lumber was torpedoed 1,300 miles west of San Francisco. Details on this news and other news that has been coming in on the Far East situation will be given to you at approximately 3:35 during the intermission of the New York Philharmonic concert. We return you now to the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. This program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
The Symphony No. 1 in F minor by the modern Russian composer Shostakovich performed as the opening work on this afternoon's Philharmonic program. Artur Rudzinski conducting. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and Manila, the Philippine Islands, from the air. The attack is developing. Today, Dean Taylor's usual commentary will be replaced by a further report on the Far Eastern situation. We pause now for 15 seconds. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is WCCO, studios in Minneapolis and St. Paul. The Twin City temperature, 37 degrees.
This is John Daly speaking from the CBS newsroom in New York. Here is the Far East situation as reported to this moment. The Japanese have attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and our defense facilities at Manila, capital of the Philippines. The first disclosure of this news was made by Presidential Secretary Stephen Early by telephone at approximately 2:25 in Washington. I read the text of this historic announcement at a little after 2:30. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. That was Secretary Early's message. Short while later, he dictated another message. A second air attack has been reported. This one has been made on the Army and Navy bases in Manila. And here's a last-minute Associated Press flash from Honolulu. A naval engagement is in progress off Honolulu with at least one black enemy aircraft carrier in action against the Pearl Harbor defenses. Secretary Early informed all correspondents and then rushed to the White House to be with President Roosevelt. As the announcement was made, the two Japanese envoys, Ambassador Nomura and Special Emissary Kurosu, were at the State Department. Columbia's correspondent in London, Bob Trout, heard the news for the first time from our report from New York. Up to that moment, or very shortly before then, the British capital had not been informed of the Japanese attack on the Hawaiian Islands and on Manila. In view of Prime Minister Churchill's recent pledge that a British declaration of war on Japan would follow almost immediately upon the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, a British announcement is expected soon. Columbia's correspondent, Ford Wilkins, was put on the air in CBS's regular 2:30 news program on Sunday afternoon from Manila. He was cut off the air suddenly while he was talking about air raid shelters, possibly because of censorship. In communication with Columbia's radio station, KGMB, in Honolulu, we heard here in New York that the Pearl Harbor base had been attacked and anti-aircraft fire was heard. A telephone message to the United Press from Fort Schaefer in Hawaii said that 50 planes attacked the island of Oahu. The planes were officially described so far as unidentified in these messages, although later reports that have come in from the press associations definitely identify at least two of these planes as carrying the emblem of the rising sun, the emblem of Japan.
...7:55 a.m., Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor near Honolulu, Hawaii. Retired U.S. Navy Lieutenant Jim Downing remembers that day as if it were yesterday.
I'd just been married for 5 months. We were having breakfast when the first bombs dropped. We turned on the radio.
And a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by...
200 miles off Hawaii, six Japanese aircraft carriers under Admiral Yamamoto had launched 353 aircraft led by Commander Mitsuo Fushida in a surprise attack against the Pacific Fleet. Jim scrambled from his house toward his ship, the USS West Virginia, berthed on Battleship Row.
So the first airplane that came my direction was all drab. I thought it was an Army plane. Then he came flying low and slow. He had machine guns. The bullets went right over my head. That's when the war became very personal.
Simultaneous air attacks were underway at six U.S. airfields. The first wave of attack along Battleship Row crippled or sunk the might of the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
We were tied up with the Oklahoma in front of us and the Arizona behind. The Oklahoma capsized and turned over. So here we were with the Oklahoma upside down in front of us and the Arizona burning like a volcano behind.
Jim first boarded the flaming deck of the USS Tennessee and slid down its 5-inch gun barrel onto the West Virginia. Massive torpedo strikes had already sunk the West Virginia into the shallow waters.
I could see the fire spreading toward the ammunition. I took a fire hose from the Tennessee and tried to cool the ammunition so it wouldn't explode because the fire was spreading to everything above the waterline.
Millions of gallons of crude oil from the USS Arizona, Oklahoma, California, and four other damaged or sinking battleships ignited the water in flames.
Oil is lighter than water, so it stayed at the top. And to see sailors being blown over the side into that oily water, sink underneath, come up, and the oil was on fire, and to see their bodies just burn like a human torch, that was the worst experience I could imagine, is seeing those human torches burning. I ran the whole gamut of emotions. The first was surprise. And then there was fear, and it turned to anger that our leadership had let us down. And then there was pride to see our men without leadership instinctively doing the right thing.
As the second wave of attacks swooped in on the USS Nevada, Jim says he felt peace while fighting the inferno.
I felt like, Lord, I'll be with you in a minute. And I fully expected to be. So I had the deepest peace I've ever felt in my life. And I think that was it. I'm going to be with you in a minute.
Jim's faith in God didn't begin in the heat of battle either.
Years earlier, aboard the West Virginia, a battleship similar to this one, Jim lived and worked alongside a group of Christian shipmates.
I was very unhappy, but Virgil was one of this group. Sing a tune, face shining, looked like he's the happiest person in the world. I knew it was Christ in him. I was attracted to Christ because of the quality of life of the guys I saw who were Christians. It was aboard the Battleship West Virginia that I gave my life to Christ because I wanted what these other people had.
Then in that crucial hour when lives were at stake, and later when his shipmates needed comfort in death, God's peace led Jim.
I knew many of them that I saw killed. We lost 108 that morning. They went down fighting. They went down trying to protect the ship and each other. I felt like everybody was a hero.
After all the fires were out, Jim rushed to the hospital. Over 3,500 Americans were dead or wounded.
My friends were burned, so I took a notebook. I went down the line of these guys in suspension and said, if you give me your parents' address and dictate a note, I'll see that they get it. The main surprise was how optimistic they were. And they told their parents, don't worry about it, I'll be all right. And they knew that George M. would die that night. But I liked their optimism.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
The next day, the United States declared war on Japan.
This was going to be a long war.
Battles in the Pacific theater alone resulted in 35 million casualties, 3% of the world's population. 100,000 civilian casualties at Okinawa heavily influenced America's use of two atomic bombs against Japan to end World War II. Jim was stationed in Washington, D.C. at the war's end, grateful the 400 gunnery trainees under his command would enjoy civilian life once again.
We were relieved that it was over. We were too close to disaster. It must never happen again.
At 102 years old, Jim is the second oldest surviving veteran of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
My main admonition out of Pearl Harbor is, remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert and strong. Because I believe that weakness invites aggression, and we must never be weak as a nation, or aggression will result.
After Jim retired from the U.S. Navy, to his surprise, he met and befriended Japan's Pearl Harbor attack commander, Mitsuo Fushida.
I met him and talked with him on several occasions. A missionary gave Fushida a Bible, and he became a Christian and became an evangelist.
They fought against each other in war, but through Christ, discovered a brotherhood of peace.
I have a favorite verse, Ezekiel 36:23. God himself said, the nations will know me when they see me in you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is James Bostic. This is A Conservative's Perspective. Welcome to our annual Pearl Harbor retrospective. 80 years ago today, December 7, 1941, a date that lives on in infamy. We take a look back at that fateful, terrible day at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The survivor's stories, the survivor's words. Here's a survivor story. You're a 15-year-old kid. And one fine Sunday morning in December, you're standing on something called the aft boat well deck of the mighty United States battleship Arizona. Off in the distance, you and your pal, Seaman First Class Bill Stafford, hear something that sounds like thunder. You and Stafford, an older friend from home who happens to be a sailor assigned to Arizona, stand there talking, wondering. Across the shipping channel, columns of smoke suddenly billow. What the hell's going on? More to the point, what's a 15-year-old sailor, strictly a visitor on board a battleship, supposed to do? You lied about your age, of course, to join the peacetime Navy. Girls, you know, they just love that uniform. Those nearby explosions are not exactly routine. Could it be some kind of gunnery practice or those planes in the sky? Black line after line coming your way. Out there across the water, there goes a smaller ship, maybe a destroyer or mine layer. A bomb hits it and breaks her in half, and that does it. Onboard Arizona, general quarters is sounded. Everyone on board, hundreds of sailors now run, racing pell-mell to their battle stations. Bill Stafford has to go too. I'll see you later, he says, and he's gone. He was a sailor on board Arizona, and he's got a battle station to go to just like everyone else. So, with the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor, with the devastating surprise attack on the United States, specifically with all that death and destruction that brought the United States into World War II, with sheer pandemonium around you, an explosion rends the ship, then a second one. The crew runs and screams. Guns begin to fire back into the sky. Your friend Stafford's gone to his duty station. And with all that, you're now standing there at the stern of the mighty ship, all alone. Alone and wondering. Can't this please, please, just be a nightmare? But for young Martin Matthews, born in Shelbyville, Kentucky, it was no nightmare. He really was there at Pearl Harbor. He really was only 15 years old at the time, and he really was in the United States Navy. But this wasn't his normal duty station. He was stationed at nearby Ford Island Naval Air Station, which was also under attack, by the way. As the last hours of peacetime dribbled away, Martin had been visiting his pal Stafford aboard Arizona the night of December 6th. After breakfast on the morning of December 7th, they planned to go sightseeing ashore. But first, they took a tour of the mighty battle wagon. And what was one of the last things the 15-year-old said to his buddy? I wish I could get duty aboard a battleship. It was one of the last things Matthews ever said to his friend, who was among the crewmen killed as Arizona was broken and sunk on that date, which will live in infamy. As a matter of fact, that day of infamy would be no solace to Martin Matthews as he watched the devastating attack unfurl before him. Watched as a boy, none too happy to be a witness there to all the death and destruction that took place that day, to witness the terrible sights. I think the second bomb that hit was close to the aft deck that I was on, and needless to say, I was petrified. Put it in plain English, it scared the living hell out of me. Concussions knocked him down a couple of times. And he got up and staggered, and he could never be sure if he jumped or was blown overboard. But he found himself in the water at the stern of the battleship, still fully clothed in his dress whites for sightseeing. He swam to a mooring buoy 20 or 30 yards away, and as he explained years later in an interview, he clung there for the remainder of the attack, unharmed, despite the chunks of metal and timber that were flying through the air. Pieces of bodies, too. Far too much for a young boy of 15 to see, he said. Close at hand, the ill-fated Arizona was soon in her final moments of agony. There was ammunition, gun lockers, shells, steel fragments and pyrotechnics coming from all parts of the ships. It was like a fireworks display, except there was a series of explosions. It wasn't just one deafening roar. But there was one decisive moment where things came to a final one, where she seemed like the middle part, just raised up in the water and kind of half buckled and then settled back down. And that was the end. The battleship couldn't sink out of sight because the water wasn't that deep, but it was the end anyway. And it was about that time that the attack finally waned. Things came to an end 3 days later. After he swam ashore, he helped with the incredible mess that the Japanese left behind. He remained a U.S. Navy sailor for the duration of the war. He served aboard 8 ships and earned a Navy Commendation Medal. He went to college after the war, like most, except that he goes down in history as a Pearl Harbor survivor, one of the youngest survivors at that time. Years old. Unbelievable. Can you imagine 15-year-old of today? Being in that situation? Unbelievable. I read a comment earlier today when I was posting the show. And basically it was, could you imagine the wokesters of today, the cancel culture of today, responding to a situation like Pearl Harbor? And I replied, I said, you know, it was only 80 years ago, but it was a considerably different breed of American who lived at that time. They had different values. They had different motivations. They had a completely different belief system. I think basically a completely different belief system based on some of the people that we see out there today. And what we're going to do now is just go ahead and get back. I wanted to share that story with you because there's no, I've never been able to find a recorded version of that. That comes out of the book, The Best Little Stories from World War II. And I think of myself at 15 and cannot for the life of me ever imagine myself being in that position. Our retrospective continues here on A Conservative's Perspective, Patriot Nation Radio.
My name is Francis Emond. That's E-M-O-N-D. I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and I was raised there until we went through high school. I worked in a mill for a couple of years, and I joined the Navy in 1938.
Is there a legacy of service in your family?
No, there is not. Most of my parents, my family, were French. They came down from Canada to work in the mills in New England.
When you joined the Navy, what was your motivation for doing so?
My main motivation was to get out of the mill where I worked because it looked like I was going to be there my whole life. So I wanted to do something a little bit more than that. I heard a radio broadcast that the Navy was looking for musicians, and I had been a French horn player in high school, so I applied for the Navy, and I was one of the few to be selected to join the Navy.
Did you enjoy playing the French horn?
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. I played it all the way through high school, but then I hadn't played it for 2 years until I joined the Navy, so it was my instrument.
Tell us a little bit about your training when you joined.
When I joined the Navy, I went to Norfolk for recruit training. And at Norfolk, I received my uniform and a bunch of shots and an indoctrination for about a month into the Navy. And then they sent me back up to Washington, D.C. to the School of Music.
So what was it like playing in the U.S. Navy band?
Well, it was fine playing in the bands. We always enjoyed that. I was assigned to Navy Band number 8. There was 23 players and one leader. So we lived together and we worked together, and we were a unit. So we were. It was nice to be to be a part of a group.
Take us through a typical day in the U.S. Navy Band. Your day, your duty, and what have you.
If it, aboard the ships, of course, I did most of my time on the ships. If the ship was in port, we would play Morning Colors, and then be rehearse a little bit maybe, and then we set up during the noontime lunch hour, and we play all through that, and then the evening we would do the same. We were in the evening at noontime we'd play some real light music, and sometime in the evening we would set up a stage band and play some of that, and then some marches and that. If we were at sea duty, if we were steaming at sea, on the Pennsylvania, our station was on the aft mast, top of the mast. We were the surface lookouts, because the ship had no radar in those days, so they had to depend on sailors with the glasses to search the seas for other ships.
Were you stationed on the USS Pennsylvania right from your training?
No. In 1938, when I joined the Navy, shortly after that, when they formed our band, we went on a shakedown cruise of a new light cruiser, the Phoenix, I believe it was the name. We went to South America, on the east coast of South America, down as far as Buenos Aires. And then we came back up the same way. And then we went back to the school for a little more training. Then we went to New York City to Flushing, where they had the 1940 World's Fair there. And we lived in tents on the edge of the fairgrounds, and every day we marched into the fair and we played colors and the arrivals of all the important the visitors they had coming. And after that we went back to the school for a little more training, and then that was 39, I believe, 39. We went to we were assigned to a cruiser in the Pacific Fleet, so we left Norfolk by an ammunition ship and went around through the canal to the west coast, and we joined our ship there. It was a light cruiser, the Honolulu, I believe it was that was the name of that one. And we stayed on the Honolulu until the middle of 1941, when our Admiral Kimmel was selected to be Sinkpack Fleet. And the admiral's ship was the battleship Pennsylvania. So when he moved to the Pennsylvania, he liked our band. So we traveled there with him. That was the reason that we were there at the time.
When would you say that you arrived at Pearl Harbor?
Late 39, they sent the Pacific Fleet to Pearl Harbor because they thought eventually that they might be having trouble there. So,
how did your fellow mates and all feel about war with Japan? Did you feel that was coming?
We all thought that it was a possibility. We were lookouts, so they were studying little cards with pictures of Japanese planes and Japanese ships, so if we happened to see one, we would know what they were. But we were not concerned with it too much.
Take me to the night before that attack on Pearl Harbor.
The night before, we were playing a dance band concert in a big hall on the 1010 dock. And the swing bands were playing, and each band would play a set of three, and then the other band would play another set. They were, one was on one side of the hall, one on the other, and we played that. We did that to about 11 o'clock, a little bit later. And since our battleship was in dry dock close to there, so a lot of our crew were there. So the winner was won by the amount of applause that they received. So we had most of our crew on the ship. So I think that's one of the reasons why we were selected to be the winner of that thing. The other bands, each battleship had a band, and even though they weren't playing, I think they all come over to listen. So we the Arizona band crew was there, and of course they were all about the same age as we were. That they were band number 22, and they left about midnight with the on their launch to go back to their ship.
All right, well, take us to December 7th, 1941, and explain that day to us.
In our group of battleships, it was our turn to play Morning Colors. So we were lined up on the stern of the of our battleship. We were in the dry dock, and we were overlooking the whole harbor. And it was a beautiful morning, and we had decided to go play tennis that morning. But at 5 minutes to eight, we saw a line of planes come in over the left. And a small plane, small prop planes, and the first one peeled off and dropped something. I thought maybe some of the tail had come off or something, so I watched it until it hit a hangar over on the air station, and that exploded up in flames and smoke and a lot of noise, which startled us, really. We looked back up and saw the big red spots on the fuselage of the airplanes. So immediately it dawned on us that was the Japanese were there. And at that time, a plane that came down from our left, from the entrance of the harbor, a torpedo plane, and I could see it drop its torpedo right by our stern. It was headed to some ships on the left. I saw the wooden floats come off the torpedoes, so the torpedoes wouldn't sink in the mud. And the man in the aft cockpit of the torpedo plane had a machine gun that looked like he was firing at us. You could see the red flashes of the machine gun. You could hear the metal clips on the turret behind us. He was shooting a little bit high, but. The torpedo went under the, I believe the, it was the Aglala, the a mine lane ship, and hit a cruiser which was alongside it on the pier. And the Aglala was a wooden ship, so I could see all the wood flying up through the air. And at that time, this all happened with a matter of seconds, like it seemed like all the same time. And And then we knew we had to get down to the battle station. And at that time, throughout the ship, you could hear the signs, general quarters, no drill. We were assigned to the aft repair party. So we started down that way. As we're going down the ladders, we went through the compartment where we slept. So I took my French horn and I put it under my mattress. I didn't know whether that was going to help or not. But we went down to our repair party and we sat there. Of course, everybody sat on the steel deck because there's no chairs around there. So. After quite a while, we felt the ship shake. So we know that we had received a bomb hit. the ship got extremely warm because there were two destroyers in the dry dock with us, and they were smashed, and all the oil had leaked into the dry dock, was on fire. So the sides of the ship was on fire with all the paint that they had on the ship. And the gunner who was in charge of our group began to get real worried with the heat, because our main guns used black powder, which was very explosive, and he was afraid it'd get too hot, that the powder might explode. But they were able to flood the dry dock a little bit in order to put the fires out, so we were safe from that. But then we got word, my friend and I, who had a stretcher, and that was our job there. So we were assigned to go pick up the dead and the wounded people.
Now, you mentioned when that plane came in, you were close enough to see the bullets coming out of the gun.
Oh, yes.
How close, explain to us how close that really was.
It was probably about 100 foot, maybe 150 foot is all.
So you could see the plane clearly.
Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. And if I close my eyes, I can still see it.
Still see that.
Right.
Now, you said that you were in charge of this, or part of the stretcher crew, so you helped...
Right. There was two of us assigned to the aft repair party, and two other... The BAM was... the members were spread around the ship where they needed men to do stuff like that.
What's the one memory that sticks in your mind from that day?
The main memory was the problem we had trying to pick up someone who was close to the blast of the bomb and the explosions, because the flesh was all burnt, so you couldn't pick them up by the flesh. You had to pick them up by the shoes, and then the uniform was undershirts and white shorts at that time. So we had a problem getting them up off the deck into the stretcher, and the smell of the burnt flesh is still something that remains with me. So.
And what did you, from there, where did you go?
They were able to repair us enough, because the bomb went down through the middle. It didn't disturb the engine or anything. So I think it was 12 days later we left. We left Pearl Harbor, our battleship, and we have one destroyer as an escort. And we went north looking for the fleets of the Japanese fleets or anything. We went up around Alaska and the Aleutians, and then back down along the coast, the west coast, and about a month later we arrived in San Francisco, and they put our ship into the repair yards there. And that was when they installed anti-aircraft guns on a ship. All those old battleships, I think there was nine of us, that had no anti-aircraft guns that could shoot at these small planes. So some of the destroyers, the newer ships, they had some, but our ships, old battleships, they were 20 years or more old, so we didn't have any then. But in the shipyard, they installed them on the ship. So.
Now, how many years were you in?
I entered in 38, and I had to leave in 68.
So what was the feeling when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered?
I just don't remember that at all. I mean, it was... I had spent the last part of World War II in the Mediterranean on the ship there as part of the Sixth Fleet. And when that ended, when the war in Europe ended, I came back to Washington to a school, and I got to be the leader of the bands. And I just don't remember, because I was way on the East Coast at that time. And so.
Any other moments that you would like to share with us in your long career?
No, I enjoyed being in the service. I enjoyed being the leader of the bands. I had a real talent for being a conductor. So I was a quite classical conductor, and I enjoyed that very much. I had a 1 3-year period in San Diego. I had a 100-piece band there for that time, which was very, very nice. And I did my last tour in Pensacola. It was very nice there. And after 30 years, I had to retire. So if they would have let me, I would have been happy to stay another 10 years, because it's nice to be a player in the band, but it's much more fun to be the leader. So
going back one last time to December 7th, remembering that day, what would be something that you remember that made you most proud?
That day, I was very proud of the ability of the crew and to take care of the wounded and get the dead out of the way and everything the way it was handled. The bomb went down the midships where the main battle dressing station was, but they had a small one in the stern of the ship, and there was one doctor there. But everyone was taken care of. We were that afternoon. We were issued rifles and ammo to, in case they invaded. So we were ready for that. But there didn't seem to be any confusion or anything. We all had the job, specific things we had to do, and everyone was at their jobs.
Once you retired from the service, what did you do in civilian life?
I was a marina manager for 10 years. And after that, I was old enough to start Social Security, so I just did a few odd jobs then. But I had two sons, and they were in college, so I had to keep up a little bit. So we just got along fine. You notice when I get going on Pearl Harbor and talking about the dead people, I start stammering a little bit.
You are awesome.
You just can't help but feel it, even though it was a long time ago.
Well, we're back, and I apologize for that long space. Sometimes Blog Talk gets a little screwy, and I don't know what else to say about that. And once again, we had to kind of overcome the technical issues with a backup plan, and that's where we are now. And I hope this sounds okay. I'm going off the speakerphone from a microphone on my cell. But anyway, here we go. We just got finished listening to Frank Emmons there talking about his time on that terrible, terrible day. It was a crippled fleet, a crippled man. At Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, repair and rescue parties were just beginning their grim work. And farther around the globe, Japanese forces were now assaulting Malaya, Hong Kong, Guam, the Philippines, Wake Island, Midway. In Washington, the polio-crippled commander-in-chief thought the better of the opening line in his draft speech, and simultaneously, at the stroke of a pen, became the more suitable suddenly. Emphatic dashes took the place of the two mid-sentence commas. The prosaic "in world history" was changed too. Set off by the helpful dashes, President Franklin D. Roosevelt's war message to the Congress of the United States would now open with its famous ringing reference point for posterity, a date which will live in infamy. Thirty-three minutes after FDR delivered his Day of Infamy speech, Congress, with but one dissenting vote, approved a resolution declaring war on Japan. The Senate vote was 82-0. The House vote count was 388-1. The single nay on December 8, 1941, being that of Representative Jeanette Rankin, a Democrat from Montana who had been one of the few members of Congress voting against war with Germany in 1917. While she had some support in those World War I days, her no vote this time stirred boos and hisses. There was no debate over this war resolution. America this time was angry, and the country was unified in shock and outrage. Roosevelt had hardly to ask. His speech broadcast live by radio. He appeared at a joint session of Congress. The cabinet and the Supreme Court were on hand as well. Millions listened at home, at offices, at factories, or at military posts. And so on a Sunday morning of 1941, the separate, even somewhat limited wars that had been raging in Europe and Asia became one war, one world war. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, a hesitant, still somewhat isolationist United States was at last pulled headlong into the vortex of violence and destruction. And not only America. In a week's time after Pearl Harbor, three dozen nations populated by one half of the planet's inhabitants were officially at war. They call it World War II in its scope, in its impact on very nearly all the peoples of the earth. It really was the first world war. No conflict like this had ever taken place before, and none since. Its worldwide spread might soon have happened anyway, some other way, but in fact, the way it did happen was with the attack on Pearl Harbor. There were loud cheers as each plane rose into the air, recalled Mitsuo Fuchida, commander of the carrier-based air armada that struck Pearl Harbor. After circling the fleet formation, we set course due south for Pearl Harbor. Under Fuchida's command, he later said, were 49 level bombers, 40 torpedo planes, 51 dive bombers, and 43 fighters. That was only the first wave, though. Soon our second wave of 171 planes swept in. And sweep they did. Surprised, caught barely awake that Sunday morning, was an American fleet of 70 combat vessels. Eight battleships were in port, seven of them neatly lined up as the famous Battleship Row. Fortunately for America, the Pacific Fleet's carriers were gone. It took less than 2 hours for the Japanese to sink or to cripple seven of the battleships, three cruisers, three destroyers, while also destroying 188 aircraft at nearby fields like Wheeler, Hickam, and Bellows, leaving 2,403 Americans dead, another 1,178 wounded. But there were still many targets which should be hit, Fuchida argued when he returned to the carrier. His urging of another attack on Pearl Harbor was overruled. Immediately, flags were hoisted. Our ships headed northwest at high speed. The Japanese lost only 29 aircraft and 55 men at Pearl Harbor, but they also, in time, lost the war. At one point during the two Pearl Harbor air attacks, Admiral Kimmel, commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, was struck with little injury by a spent bullet that flew into his office window. Aware of the tragedy that was unfolding around him and the blame that would be his, he put the bullet in the pocket and said, "It would have been merciful had it killed me." Kimmel, along with the local U.S. Army commander, General Walter Short, was indeed relieved from their posts. Mitsuo Fuchida, meanwhile, survived severe injury in the later Battle of Midway, and after the war became a Christian convert, a Protestant minister, and a United States citizen.
Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Off to the seven seas.
Seems kinda tough now to say goodbye this way. But Papa's gotta be rough now so that he can be sweet to you another day. Shh, baby. Shh, baby. Shoo, 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 baby. Goodbye, goodbye. Your Papa's off to the seven seas. Your big tall papa's off to the seven seas.
Now,
yeah.
Okay, I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old with mother's permission. In those days they had what they called minority crews and you could go in at 17. So I never finished high school, and I joined the Navy in 1938, so I had over 3 years in when the war started here, and I was right out here on the battleship Oklahoma, and my station was in the engine room, and there were 54 men in my division. So far as I know, only four of us survived out of the 54. There may have been some others, but that's all I had heard of. So I was pretty fortunate there, and I stayed on the ship until it listed about 30 degrees. And then I thought it was time to leave because 30 degrees is getting over there pretty good. And when I got the top side, it went on over. My buddy was with me. He went uphill and went over to the battleship Maryland, which we were tied up to. And it was too steep for me to go up there. By the time I got out the ventilator, and I slid down into the water. So I had to swim. And
how far did you have to swim?
Well, I swam trying. See, just as I slid down there, the ship turned over onto me and covered me. So I tried to swim out from under it, and I was an excellent swimmer, but I couldn't find the surface. There was something over the top of me. So I finally gave up. And finally, I ended up in a life raft. How I got there, I don't know. I think it was due to either an explosion or the ship making a sudden movement and forced me out of the water. I don't know. But I ended up in a life raft.
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
As what?
Do you think you were unconscious at that time?
I was. I was. Because I had given up. But then after I was in the life raft for a few minutes, got my breath back again, and the fellas had a couple of wounded men in the life raft, and they gave me the dickens for jumping into the life raft. I don't know. I didn't know how I got there. So I knew I wasn't wanted, so I jumped back in the water and started swimming over here to the submarine base. This is what was my goal. And actually, my ship was right out there where the Missouri is. So it's quite a swim from there to here. But I swam probably a fourth of the way, and I was picked up by a motor launch. But then I got back over here to the submarine base, and I heard that they had heard some tapping on the hull of the Oklahoma. If you've seen pictures of it, about a third of the hull was still above water. And so I went back out there, and I worked on it for 2 days. We were cutting people out, and we rescued 32 men. And that's where I spent the next 2 days. And then after that, I went out to sea. I grabbed the first destroyer I could get on and went to sea because I wanted to kill a Jap. That was my goal.
Can you state your name and spell it? Just say it out loud.
Say what?
Just say, say your name.
Walter Becker.
Can you spell it? Can you spell it for us? Just spell it for us.
Oh, spell it? Oh, W-A-L-T-E-R. B-E-C-K-E-R. Is it showing there?
Yeah.
Okay.
That way when they're putting it all together, they'll have your name right.
Yeah. But anyway, I went to sea on a destroyer, and 9 months later, it was sunk. We lost it at Guadalcanal.
Oh, wow.
So then I was on an oil tanker for about a year and a half. Then I went aboard a small aircraft carrier, and it was sunk. We lost it at Iwo Jima. So I was a hell of a swimmer.
There you go. You got lots of practice.
Yeah. But there's not very many people you'll ever talk to that survived three ships.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
How long did you stay in the Navy?
7 years total.
So all of that within 7 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, actually within 5 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it was The action was all within about a 4-year period.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's about the extent of it.
Tell us what coming here means to you.
Oh, I think about so many of the fellows that were good friends of mine, and I feel that it's pretty much a duty for me to go over here and commemorate them. I just get a different feeling when I'm over here thinking about them, because I did lose a lot of friends. Like on Oklahoma, we lost 427 men. On the Bismarck Sea, which was the little aircraft carrier, I think there we lost 320, about a third of the crew. So it's been a little rough, but actually I've been fortunate, had a good life, was married for 63 years. My wife died a little over a year ago, so raised two children. One of them is here with me, and one grandson's here with me. And been fairly fortunate, made a decent living, always had something to eat, had clothes on my back.
What did you do after the Navy?
Well, for the first 10 years, I farmed. And then I hurt my back, and I had to quit farming because I couldn't ride a tractor anymore. And I started selling firefighting equipment. And we built fire trucks until about 3 years ago.
Wow.
Got fire trucks all over the nation.
Great.
Yeah, with my name on them. Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
I think you've about got my history.
Well, we're very, very glad that you are a good swimmer.
Yeah.
When I awoke on the morning of December 7th, I had the duty in the 4th Division. And the division was clean up any activity that we had going and to arrange the ceremonies for our church on the fantail of the ship. So I took my working party and we commenced to do all this sort of thing. And we were a little late getting into the mess hall for breakfast. So we got this straightened out and we went inside to eat. And about the time I got inside to get a chance to eat something, I heard a loud explosion. And I thought, what in the dickens is that? And then one of the mess cooks looked out the porthole and saw the explosion and called me and he said, Andy, you were in China just recently, really? Yes. Well, you know what it was? Did you see that? And I said, no. He said, get out and take a look. So I went outside the hatch onto the main quarter deck, looked up and saw this plane with dipping like this, and it had red balls on its wings. And I said, I said a cuss word, and I said, the Japanese are here. We already knew this was going to happen sometime, but they're here. And so I ran back toward the hatch door to pull the general alarm. And about the time I got to pull it, which I never did, a bomb dropped between us and the vessel. And it blew me inside the hatch, knocked me silly. And I, of course, you know, that set off a wildfire. And of course, the Japanese were then machine gunning the decks, like spraying the decks with machine gun fire. Then more bombs began to drop around us. And of course, we immediately did what we were supposed to do, go to our general quarters station. So I got up off the deck, went down to the lower hatches and back up into the bar bed of number 4 turret, because I was a gunner on my battle station in number 4 turret. And I got into the seat and said, manned and ready. In the meantime, I told the turret captain, Campbell, I said, look, what I saw out there was a number of Japanese planes, I didn't see any ships or anything, and no shell fire. There's all bombs and machine gun fire. And he said, well, what do you suggest? And I said, well, we can't do any good in here. We need some gunners on the anti-aircraft batteries. And if those guys are dead, who's going to defend us with from those planes up there? And he says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to get out there and get on a gun with my brother. He's an anti-aircraft gun captain, and he needs help. And he said, go for it. So I said, okay. So I talked to a couple other guys that was in there with me, Hog Otterman and Dwayne Barth and Lewis and several other guys. I said, I'm going out the trap door and I'm going up there and get on the guns. If you guys want to stay here, you can do that and man this turret. If they start shelling us, I'll come back. So I won't be gone that long. So I got out of the turret, went out from the overhang of the turret, and started up the ladder to the boat deck where all the anti-aircraft guns were. Well, I got to the top of the ladder, and an enormous explosion occurred, and people were just blown all over the place. There was all kinds of body parts, different... there was nothing that I could do to do anything, and a tremendous fire broke out. And then explosions of our artillery that was up there, ammunition started blowing. Knocked me back back as far as number 4 turret. And on the way back, I grabbed a guy by the hand who was on fire, and I held on to him. And he was from Greenfield, Ohio. I never forgot that. And I saved him. I got him out of there. But he was on fire. I got the fire out. And then, of course, there's nothing I could do because everybody was trying to salvage somebody or get them off where they were free and clear. But nobody was free and clear. And some small craft were around us, but they didn't venture too close. But one of them did. And Admiral Fuqua, who was the senior surviving officer there on board, was yelling at me to get in one of those boats. And when I was dumping guys, wounded people that I could find, who were still in one piece, into the boat to take them ashore to the bunker over there on Fort Island. And so he yelling at me to get off. And I said, Mike, I'm not leaving. My brother's there someplace. I got to find him. And he said, he can't make it. He couldn't have made it. You just get in there. He said, this place is going to blow. That magazine under you was almost hit by one. And he said, it's not able to go. He says, get out of here, but I wouldn't go. Well, he gave me a big shove. In the meantime, one of the bombs hit the turret that we had been in, and it skidded off the faceplate, which is about 16-inch steel, the faceplate, and went down below and exploded below and killed members of the CIC, Combat Information Center. But we weren't there at the time. We were looking for a different spot on the ship there. And... So finally, I got over there to the starboard quarter, which is the right-hand quarter of the ship, where that small boat had got in. And a fellow named Alexander was a pilot of this small craft, which I didn't think I'd ever forget, and I didn't this time. And Alexander said, come on, give me the guy. As he did, and I said, no. He said, got any more? And he said, yes. He said, well, get him in here, let's get him on. In the meantime, Admiral Fuqua, who was a lieutenant commander at that time, came over to me and said, you got to get in the boat. We want to save as many men as we can. Get in there. I said, well, I'm not going. He says, yes, you are. And he shoved me in with a loaded, wounded man in my hands. So I got in the boat, whether I wanted to or not, and they took off for Fort Island. We got to Fort Island. We unloaded the dead and wounded on some flatbed trucks that came down there to get them. And then I stood outside the bunker and I looked out there at the Arizona and I said, it's still on fire, but maybe we can get back and do something. And there's a small craft floating by itself, nobody in it. And I turned around and saw this kid standing next to me and I said, Rose, are you ready to drive out back out there and go at it again? He says, if you are, I am. So we swam out, got in that boat, which was just adrift of the Arizona stern, and drove back up alongside the port quarter of the Arizona. That's the left side. And I climbed aboard, and he held us alongside. And we did rescue three guys. They were alive. we had so many dead ones that I couldn't tell. In the time that I had, I couldn't have. And other guys were trying to do the same thing, but they must have gone by the time we got back. And I had to take what we could get. So we took these three guys and tried to make sure they were okay. And we drove on down. I was a pilot of this small craft. Drove on down past the Oklahoma and the West Virginia. And we got down to the seaplane ramp, and a shell or something hit our boat. And it could have been an explosive machine gun fire, explosive bullets. Anyway, it blew our boat apart and lost those three guys and Rose. And I was the only one lived alive in that. And I swam around there, and the oil was on fire too, by the way, from exploded oil tanks. I swam around in this splashing water, trying to duck planes when they're firing on us. And there was other people out there in the water too, besides me. And I tried to find these guys we had and get them ashore to Fort Island. But I ran out of gas. I just couldn't do it anymore. So I managed to make it ashore and just fell down on the ground there on the beach. And then Japanese were still running back and forth. A new batch of them from up there came in. It's like second wave, I think. But anyway, they peppered the beach with machine gun fire. And, of course, I had to get off the beach before I got hit myself again. And I ran up to the runway, which is on Fort Island, not too far from the beach. And there was a tree and several trees there. And one of them had a 19.3 Springfield rifle and two bandoliers of ammunition hanging over a limb there. I said, my God, this is my serious, this is what's saving me. I've got myself a rifle and two bandoliers of ammunition, and that's about 215 rounds, and I'm going to be able to do some good. I took off down the runway and found a bomb hole in the runway and parked there. And got in there, and of course, for some reason or other, they didn't come back and bomb us again. They were down there blowing up the planes a little further away from us. And so a little while later, another guy named, anyway, this other fellow came on. He was in a Marine uniform, dress uniform, and he looked at me and he said, hey, Andy, what are you doing there? And I said, well, that's where I'm going to make my stand. He says, well, I've got a machine gun. We can give them hell. I said, okay, park with me and we'll ride it out, make our stand here. So he parked in there. And of course, the Enterprise was offshore about, I don't know, maybe 200 miles or so, and their planes were coming into land. I guess they weren't aware that it was happening at Pearl. And so they came in trying to land. This was getting dark. And so we didn't know who these people were, whether they were enemy coming back for another run at us or what. Well, my 19.3 Springfield wasn't very good against nighttime pilots and planes. So I didn't do so good with that. And my friend, who later became a sheriff in Georgia, Valdosta, Georgia, Walt Gaskins, that was his name. I couldn't think of his name when I was talking about him. Walt Gaskins. Walt survived the war and went to be a sheriff in Valdosta, Georgia. And but in the meantime, the next morning, we stayed there all night. The next morning, the word came out, the Marines spread a squad out all over looking for fellows who had been hurt, but nobody knew about it. They wanted to find them and pick up the casualties and get the guys back to their own ship if they still could make it. And so they came on to me and Gaskins and told us to report to 1010 Dock, which was across from the Fort Island on the mainland of Honolulu and or Pearl. And we went over there and found out there was about maybe 200 guys, all walking wounded, Arizona survivors on 1010 Dock. This man's name was Commander Geiselman. He was a survivor of the Arizona, but he wasn't on the ship when the bombing took place. He'd been ashore. but he'd got out as close as he could to do some good. And so he organized us all together, found out who was needed to go to the hospital and needed to be wrapped up right there with first aid and to get something to eat, some water, because everybody was dry as a bone. Nobody had any water. And volunteer for hazardous duty. So I wanted to stay with our Arizona crowd of survivors and man a ship ourselves. But Captain Geiselman, or Commander Geiselman said, no, you can't do that. We got to flesh out the ships who've lost men and they need replacements. And you guys are trained sailors and you're all good at it. And you got to fill out the blanks. So we got to get the ships to sea right now. We got to get a fleet out there to battle the Japanese. And when it came around to me, I said, I'll volunteer. I'll go. And they said, okay. So they sent me to a destroyer, the McDonough. And the McDonough had a landing force, which I'd been doing in China in another destroyer. So I fought from Pearl Harbor on all the way across the Pacific in so many scrapes and fights that I never even forgot the names of the places. But we did raid New Guinea, two or three places, Hollandia, Salamaua and Ley and New Guinea, and landed at Guadalcanal with the 1st Marine Division. And then we landed at Truk, we raided Truk. And all of these raids were pretty dangerous business.
And John, tell us what you know about what happened to your brother and give us his name.
I didn't know what happened to my brother. I was out in the Pacific and found out that there was a gunner that was on the boat deck who had charge of all those guns up there, and my brother was under his command. And he said that he saw, he put out a brief that he saw Anderson knocked down by gunfire. He was a gun captain on a gun. And then when the explosion occurred, the gunner got blown overboard. So he didn't know what happened other than most people up there were burned to death or blown to pieces. So they never did find my brother's body. But the last I know about is what this gunner had to say later. And the gunner, of course, was killed after he'd done this against the kamikazes off the sea off Okinawa when the kamikazes were coming in on the Pacific Fleet units. The gunner was out there and was killed there. So that was the last anybody ever had on my boiler.
My name is Don Long. I served in the Navy. I happened to be at Pearl Harbor in 1941 after enlisting in March of 1941 in Minnesota. Farm kid, manure still on my shoes. Got to Hawaii in November of 1941. Was assigned to an aircraft squadron, PBYs. I was a radioman. We were based at Kaneohe Bay in Hawaii. It's right across the island from Pearl Harbor. And that's where I was on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
I'd finished radio school in Alameda and got assigned to Hawaii, which of course I think was every young farm boy's dream in those days. The morning of December 7th, that the squadron that I was in, we had some planes on the water, and I was in one of those airplanes. The procedure is that if there is a plane anchored on the water, that somebody's in it at all times, quote, just in case. I had just relieved the fellow who got off, who was on the plane the night before. It was about 7:45 in the morning, and I was getting ready for the day's activities that we had planned. We were going to do a little signal practicing with the shore, and I heard some airplanes overhead. I looked out, I saw some planes up in the air, thought it was the Army Air Force doing some Sunday maneuvers. Moments later, the plane started coming in my direction, and one of them opened fire, strafing the airplane that I was in. Just about the same time, there were bombs going off, exploding, when the overhead bombers, they were dropping bombs on the shore establishment, on the hangars, the airplanes on the ground. The planes, we had them all lined up there at the base, and the strafing airplanes, the incoming planes, were strafing the planes on the ground and on the water. The plane that I was in was hit, I'm going to say, almost instantly. It burst into flame. The gas tanks did not have bulletproof rubber liners in them in those days, and the plane and everything was immediately engulfed in fire. I just happened to be in the middle of it. I can recall seeing the little spouts of water shooting up where the bullets went through the bottom of the plane. This was on my way trying to get out, which I did. I went to the back blister of the airplane and jumped into the water. At the time, the water, of course, was all aflame with gas and oil, but at boot camp, fortunately, they had taught us how to swim through a burning, quote, water, and that's what I did. You just jump in feet first with hands over your head, such like this, and then go under the water, stay as long as you can, swim as far away as you can, and then when you need air to come up, and then with your hands, just wave them back and forth, spread the flames, come up for a second, 2 seconds, gulp of air, go back down, swim off and do it again. So that worked well for me. There was a buoy a couple of hundred yards away that I saw. I swam over to that. My logic at the time, I can recall, was that I thought if they would try to strafe me in the water, if they saw me, that I could climb under that buoy. And I thought I might be protected. That never happened. I want to add that there was never any action at me directly. They were attacking the planes and the hangars, but I didn't see anything that I thought was coming after me as an individual. A little while later, I noted a boat was coming out from the shore, and they were out there looking for survivors, and they came over and picked me up. Fortunately for me, but unfortunately for the other guys, I was the only one that did survive the strafing of the planes that were on the water and stuff. The fast forward 75 years. 2 years ago, I was invited to go back to Pearl Harbor. I had been there before, but I invited to go back with a group for the 75th Pearl Harbor anniversary. It incidentally put in a plug for the Greatest Foundation. They were the ones that took us back there, and it was a very memorable trip. This year, I've been asked to participate in a ceremony in Concord. Each December 7th, a group
They sponsor a beacon lighting ceremony, and I've been invited to participate in that, so I will be in Concord.
My name is Herb Weatherwax. I was born in Honolulu on June 3rd, 1917. I heard a very loud explosion in Honolulu, and I looked in the direction of the explosion, and that was over Pearl Harbor, and I saw the sky just black with smoke, a big cloud of smoke, and I could hear the anti-aircraft guns firing. I could hear that boom, 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 which is a sound I was familiar with because they used to have dry runs in that particular area. So I turned the radio on to find out what was going on, and they announced over the radio that all military personnel report to the station immediately. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. It was more than the material damages that was done. It affected the lives of all the young men that were here at that time, that were involved and was entrapped in the ships that was bombed, and especially the Arizona. I visited Memorial quite frequently and get to talk to the people about how it was that morning, how I saw it. When I was called back to my station, I got on a bus in Honolulu, and the bus is a regular transportation that troops had at that time to go to Honolulu and back to Schofield Barracks. And as I passed by the Arizona, right at the entrance of the bay, I looked out and I was just shocked to see such a huge ship just enveloped in flames. The flames were so huge. And the sight that I saw there with all the other battleships ablaze, and the Oklahoma had been already torpedoed and she flipped over on the side. And I remember seeing little objects scrambling on the hull of the Oklahoma. Those are the things that left a tremendous impression on my mind. I volunteered for the Visitor Center because this is an opportunity for me to give my story out to the hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of visitors that come out here. I have a story to pass on to let them know how things were to be and they should be. And I think that the people, every American, if it's possible, should come to Hawaii and visit the memorial. Especially, never miss the memorial. That's very, very important.
Thank you for remembering my husband.
Well, we're back. Blog Talk's a funny thing, man, and that's all I'm going to say about it. As we enter this troubled December, let us reach back as we have 80 years to another December and 8 days that gave birth to this world of peril and promise that we occupy today. In the first days of December 1941, the German army was approaching Moscow from the north, the west, and the south. The Wehrmacht steadily advanced despite snow, bitter cold, and fanatical resistance. Everyone in Europe and the United States braced for word that the Soviet capital had fallen. The Soviet Union, a horrible entity to be sure, seemed doomed. But General Georgi Zhukov had assembled a massive reserve of nearly 60 divisions. On December 5th, he unleashed a counterattack against the German forces to the northwest of Moscow. The attack achieved total surprise. The Germans reeled backward. On December 6th, Zhukov launched attacks to the west and southwest. Again, the Germans were driven back. The counteroffense of Zhukov ended Hitler's hope for a decisive victory in 1941. Hitler and his generals now knew that they were locked in a war of attrition with the Soviet Union, a war of attrition with an adversary possessing twice their population and a greater industrial base augmented by lend-lease supply. The Germans also faced a regime and a leader even more ruthless and brutal than their own. The Soviet offensive on December 7th continued, but the eyes of the world shifted elsewhere to the Pacific Ocean. That morning, hundreds of Japanese aircraft descended on the airfields and naval berths of Oahu in the Hawaiian Islands. Over 2,400 American servicemen were killed, and an array of warships and planes lay in wreckage. 7 hours after the attack, Japan belatedly declared war on the United States and Great Britain. Also that day, the tentacles of Japan reached elsewhere. Their troops invaded Thailand, Malaya, Hong Kong. Their warplanes struck Singapore, the Philippines, Guam, and Wake Island. Also that day in Germany, Adolf Hitler issued the sinister Night and Fog Decree. The secret decree allowed for the disappearance of political opponents and resistance fighters. Most of the thousands of victims were seized at night, and no word was given to families of their fate, usually death in the concentration camps. On December 8th, President Roosevelt delivered his famous "A Date Which Will Live in Infamy" speech to a joint session of Congress. It's inspiring to watch video of that speech, both the ringing call to arms by FDR when he said, "The American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory," and the roaring cheers of the united audience. Shortly after the speech, Congress declared war on the Empire of Japan. On December 9th, China declared war on Japan, Germany, and Italy. Japan had already inflicted great devastation and death on China. It's little noted in the West that Japan killed nearly 4 million Chinese civilians, often marked by appalling atrocities like the ones that they experienced in Nanking. China has not forgotten, nor has China forgiven. December 10th brought the sinking off the Malayan coast of the British warships Repulse and Prince of Wales. Japanese torpedo planes dealt the fatal blows. The sinking of the two capital ships by aircraft shocked the world and announced the arrival of a new age in naval warfare, and the British should not have been surprised, because 6 months earlier, their own torpedo bombers had disabled the German battleship Bismarck. But it was December 11th, 1941 brought the decisive day of World War II. In the greatest blunder of that war, Adolf Hitler delivered a speech before Reichstag deputies in Berlin. Citing a long list of grievances, he declared war on the most powerful economic nation in the world. And over the next 4 years, that nation would also become the supreme military power of the world. In turn, the United States declared war on Germany. And we have to remember that prior to December 7th, the nation was vehemently split between the interventionists and the isolationists. In the immediate days after the Pearl Harbor attack, united support existed only for war with Japan. William L. Shirer wrote, "My own impression in Washington at that moment was that it might be difficult for President Roosevelt to get Congress to declare war on Germany. There seemed to be a strong feeling in both houses, as well as in the Army and the Navy, that the country ought to concentrate its efforts on defeating Japan and not take on the additional burden of fighting Germany at the same time." Without the United States at war against Nazi Germany, it's doubtful the British could have successfully invaded France, nor is it likely that the British alone could have expelled the Germans from North Africa or landed in Sicily or Italy. Without American involvement, the Nazis perhaps to this day would remain masters of Western Europe. With the United States sidelined, the Germans could have concentrated nearly full force against the Soviets. Could the Wehrmacht have raised the price in blood high enough to gain a stalemate in the East? Already, it had achieved a 6-to-1 casualty ratio in battle. With forces not needed for a second front, at the very least, the Germans could have greatly slowed any Soviet advance. We must also consider that with America battling only in the Pacific and the Soviets slowed down, Germany would have had time to develop and field impressive numbers of their advanced weapons, to, for example, jet fighters and bombers, ballistic and guided missiles, fortress tanks, night vision equipment, and yes, eventually nuclear weapons. All this Hitler negated by his astounding error of December 11th. If Hitler had decided otherwise, the world today could be profoundly different. On the last of the 8 days, December 12th, Hitler made another decision, one which still haunts us many years after the destruction of his heinous regime. In a meeting in the Reich Chancellery with top subordinates, Hitler gave the green light for the Holocaust. Prior to this meeting, SS death squads had murdered many thousands of Jews in Poland and in the USSR. But annihilation of European Jewry was not yet an official policy. This decision laid the foundation for the death factories, which methodically consumed millions of Jews and others hated by Hitler. 8 days in December of 1941, 80 years ago, 8 days which wrenched the world into total war and unleashed the worst of our demonic impulses. Are the leaders of the great powers of today wise enough to refrain from initiating another global war? The present world, for all its troubles, is on the verge of creating paradise. A world where want, disease, maybe even death itself would fade away. Where humankind can achieve Winston Churchill's vision of moving forward into broad, sunlit uplands. And as we move toward another Christmas, let us pray for that vision to become a reality.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Yeah, we'll meet again. I don't know where, and I don't know when, but I do know that we'll meet again some sunny day. So honey, keep on smiling through, just like you always do. fill the blue skies, drive all the dark clouds far away. And will you please say hello to all the folks that I know, and tell them that I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.
We'll meet again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Hey, everybody. James Bostic, a conservative perspective. Thank you, number one, for joining us on what I consider a very special show. I always look forward to doing the Pearl Harbor and the Normandy invasion retrospectives. I've done it for a number of years now, and I always look forward to it. We had listeners tonight in Alaska. Shout out to those folks way up north. And we had folks, we had Devil Dogs down at Camp Lejeune listening as well, and I'm insufferably proud of that. I bid you all welcome, and I also beg your forgiveness. This show didn't turn out exactly the way I wanted it to. Blog Talk is a terrific platform most of the time, and it allows folks, you know, that have things that they want to say on a variety of different subjects, an opportunity to do so. And ordinarily, the technology is such that things can sound pretty good. Not necessarily the case tonight. Nonetheless, I appreciate you bearing with me and staying and helping me, really, to pay homage to that greatest of generations. A conservative perspective is heard here ordinarily Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we have a recorded version of the program that goes out on the Mojo 50 radio network, MOJO50.com. If you're not listening, you should be. It is the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio out there, mojo50.com. Thank you so much. We're going to end things a little bit early, and mercifully so. Again, I apologize for the technical difficulties, and I am exceedingly grateful that you were able to stick it out and come through the program with us. Thursday, we'll be back here, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Lord willing, and the river don't rise. Blog Talk don't blow up when I hit the live button. Take a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you then.